Good evening. I'm Dr. Elliot Malamut. At the end of the 8th century, Harun al-Rashid, who was a caliph of the Abbasid dynasty, built a palace in Raqqa, which is on the Euphrates River, which is now Syria. And as the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Steve Cole wrote recently, al-Rashid's empire stretched from modern Tunisia to Pakistan. It was an age of Islamic discovery and science, music, and art. Rashid's court of viziers inspired stories in 1001 Nights. In June, the Islamic State in Iraq, ISIS, declared Raqqa the seat of a new caliphate, presided over by Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, a fierce preacher who was once an American prisoner in Iraq and is now in hiding. The city has lost its splendor. Public executions are a common spectacle on Fridays in El Naim Square or at the Al-Tha'a roundabout. ISIS fighters mount the dead on crucifixes, quote, as a warning to local inhabitants, unquote. Something is happening in our world in front of our very eyes, from the beheadings of journalists to the kidnappings of hundreds of Nigerian girls, from the hacking to death in full public view of British Army soldier Fusilier drummer Lee Rigby of the Royal Regiment of Fusiliers, to the shooting down of a plane in midair in the Ukraine, to the lawless proliferation of non-state actors equipped with sophisticated weapons and primitive ideologies, something is happening. A new world order, or a new world disorder, if you will. And on that uplifting note, it's my pleasure to introduce my friend Melanie Phillips, who was raised and educated in London before attending Oxford University. She's had a distinguished career as a journalist and an author, currently a columnist for the London Times and the Jerusalem Post. Ms. Phillips formerly wrote for the Daily Mail and also The Guardian. She's a regular panelist on BBC Radio 4 program The Moral Maze and BBC One's Question Time. She was awarded the Orwell Prize for Journalism in 1996 and is the author of several books, including Londonistan, which was published in the US and UK in 2006 and immediately became a bestseller, and The World Turned Upside Down, The Global Battle Over God, Truth and Power, which was published in 2010. In that book, Ms. Phillips argues the following: in what we tell ourselves in an age of reason, we are behaving increasingly irrationally. Truth and lies, right and wrong, victim and aggressor are all turned upside down. The West is losing both its rationality and its freedoms. And while the Islamists are intent on returning the free world to the 7th century, the West no longer seems willing or able to defend the modernity and rationalism that it brought into being. Ms. Phillips and I last dialogued in Toronto 4 years ago, and I thought it would be a good opportunity this evening to renew the conversation. Please welcome Melanie Phillips. Okay, so the core thesis of both Londonistan and The World Turned Upside Down is that Britain and Western society as a whole has become impotent and afraid to defend its own values. Let's talk a little bit about what has happened in England specifically. So a Muslim member of British Parliament claims there are over twice as many young British Muslims fighting in ISIS than there are serving in the UK's armed forces. Khalid Mahmood, who's the MP for Perry Barr in Birmingham, estimates that at least 1,500 young British Muslims have been recruited by extremists fighting in Iraq and Syria in the last 3 years. And according to the Ministry of Defense, there's only 600 British Muslims currently serving in the armed forces. So Mahmood, who's a Muslim, said that British government was failing to deal with the problem of homegrown extremists. He says, we've not concentrated on the prevention work. We haven't invested enough in de-radicalization. It's tragic, and somebody's got to wake up to it. So if you add to this the Lee Rigby killing, which I mentioned before, and of course that the beheader of the journalist James Foley was British, there's a chilling picture that emerges. And I'm wondering if you can estimate or speculate, is England lost? Right? Will it stand up against extremism? And if it won't, why not?
Well, whether England is lost is very much a moot point, and no one can answer that question at the moment. No one can answer whether Britain is lost. Britain very nearly lost Scotland a few weeks ago into the North Sea. And I have to say that most people in England would have cheerfully towed Scotland out of the North Sea and sunk it. But is Britain lost? Is Europe lost? No one knows the answer to that, and no one knows whether Britain and Europe are going to realise that they are on what I consider to be the edge of a civilizational cliff and are about to go over the edge. At the moment, in my view, they don't even know they're on a cliff, let alone near the edge of it. And what I mean by that is that I think for the last 30, 40 years, they have been, particularly in Britain, they have been undermining the core concepts, the core values of what keeps Britain, of British national identity. And this is there's a long and complex story behind all this. But it's basically to do with a sense of demoralization in Britain and Europe, which I think you can trace back to the First World War, a sense that Western society, Western civilization is kind of exhausted, that the age of reason in the country that considered itself to be the center of reason, which was Germany, produced Nazism and the Holocaust, a sense that after the carnage of the First World War, war was such a terrible thing and was so pointless because of that slaughter must never be encountered again, must never be entertained again. And that produced a mood of appeasement. And then you get cultural confusion since the Second World War, in which a very determined attempt has been made, in Britain almost completely successful, to upturn all the sort of core values of Western civilization, starting with the most important, which is the notion that there is such a thing as absolute truth. Everyone knows, every student knows, that anyone like me who thinks there is such a thing as absolute truth is an absolute fossil, a throwback. I must be exceptionally stupid. I am obviously extremely uneducated. I am very, very unsophisticated, because anyone who's sophisticated, anyone who's educated, knows that the idea that there is such a thing as absolute truth is laughable. Everything is a matter of opinion. Everything is a matter of a competing narrative. So if I come along and I say, Israel is not the aggressor in Gaza because Israel has been the victim of thousands of rockets, people say, but that's not a fact, that's your opinion. And what's more, your opinion is worthless, because we all know that you are a extreme Zionist, Likudnik, warmongering Jew. So your opinion is actually worthless. But nevertheless, it is your opinion, and we have to consider someone else's opinion. That's your narrative. We have to consider the Hamas narrative. They also are entitled to have a narrative, which, in the spirit of fairness, we must consider. So this is the kind of situation that Britain has got itself into, that in the interest of fairness, you can't say that something is absolutely bad. You can't say that Hamas is absolutely bad. You can't say that Iran is absolutely bad. Iran is threatening genocide? Well, they may have a point. It's really like that. And consequently, you have this kind of moral debauchery in which Britain has become particularly vulnerable to Islamic extremism, because Islamic extremism turns right and wrong upside down. And this is absolutely devastating, because instead of saying we're being told lies, the British say, well, maybe they've got a point. And this is having a number of particular effects, because what I've just been describing is what homegrown indigenous Brits have done to themselves. They've kind of hollowed out their own society. They've hollowed out their own values. They don't know what they believe anymore. They don't believe there's such a thing as truth. They certainly don't believe in biblical morality. They don't really think that there is a nation, a national identity they can identify with or should identify with. They've been taught that nations lead to nationalism and nationalism leads to war. And consequently, if you want to avoid bigotry and prejudice and war, you have to basically say the nation must give way to something bigger than the nation, the brotherhood of man. So instead of the nation adhering to laws passed by its own democratic parliament, we must subjugate that to international law, to international human rights law, to international or supranational institutions like the United Nations, like the International Criminal Court, like the European Court of Justice. These institutions deal with laws that go beyond one nation. They bind us all together, don't they, as the brotherhood of man. And consequently, that's where legitimacy lies, not in national laws. So you've had a situation where Britain, in particular, has been in the forefront of this, has lost its sense of what a nation is and what national identity is, especially among young people. People of my generation know what it is, but, you know, people of my generation are literally dying out. So then you have this lethal thing that comes into the middle of this vacuum, and that is the homegrown British Muslim, mainly boys, but there are some girls, but they're mainly boys, who are turning to extremism. You mentioned, Elliot, the figure which says, you know, there are more British Muslim extremists signed up to extremism and terrorism than serving in the British Army. That's been the case for quite some time. The security service in Britain has said that at least 500, probably many more hundreds, British Muslim boys have gone to Syria to fight for ISIS, they have signed up with Islamic State. And as such, they have been indoctrinated, they will have been indoctrinated into a set of ideas, which means that if they come back to Britain, they are such a danger to the British state that they cannot be allowed back. We don't know what to do with them. So then the question is, why are they all doing this? Why are these boys all signing up? And, you know, this is not a new thing. Islamic State is a new thing. But we've had this problem of homegrown British Muslim radicalism among the young for a number of years. We had our own 9/11 in 2005. You may remember the London tube and bus bombings, where four homegrown British jihadis blew themselves up on buses and trains and murdered 52 people. And at the time, the British said to themselves, well, in order to explain this terrible phenomenon that British boys had done this to their own people, British people, they said, well, the explanation must be that they were poor. It must be that they were marginalised, uneducated. It must be that they were the victims of discrimination, Islamophobia. What it couldn't be was anything to do with Islam, because you can't say that in Britain. You cannot say that. You cannot say there's anything wrong with Islam, and you cannot say that anyone who blows themselves up and says Allahu Akbar and says that I'm doing this in the name of God, you can't say it's got anything to do with Islam. You can't say it when they cite chapter and verse from the Quran and the Hadith. You can't say it's got anything to do with Islam. And indeed, our Prime Minister, Mr. Cameron, as was also said by President Obama, apropos of Islamic State. You know, here you have Islamic State, which is setting up a caliphate, which is, you know, the ancient Islamic empire. And we are told by Prime Minister Cameron and President Obama it's got nothing to do with Islam. So you have this sort of insanity. So, when it came to the motivation of these British boys, all these alibis over the years have got knocked away, because it became clear that most of them were not did not come from poor and deprived backgrounds. They came from good families. They had been educated at regular British schools, and they had been radicalised very often on British campuses. So all these alibis got knocked away, and you have a situation now where I read a few days ago there was a report which said that, and this goes beyond British Muslim boys, a survey has shown 1 in 8 in Britain support Islamic State. 1 in 8. 60 million people in Britain, 65 million. 1 in 8 support Islamic State, and not all of them are Muslims. So what is going on here? And as far as the Muslim boys are concerned, why are they joining up? Why have they always joined up? Well, a number of reasons. Classically, they are caught between cultures. These are boys born and bred in Britain to Muslim families. The Muslim families very often are not particularly pious. They're not particularly observant. They're certainly not radical. But they have these children who are born into Britain, educated in British schools, and become radical. Why is that? Partly because they are caught between cultures. They are British boys, and they are exposed to the wonders of contemporary British culture, that is to say, sex, drugs, and alcohol. And they enthusiastically take part because they are British boys and they behave like their peer group. But they're full of disgust because they are Muslims. And they know that it's wrong. There's a sense that, you know, a cultural sense that they are offending against something that is important, and probably their parents really don't approve. And they become, they're in a kind of limbo land. And they go to university, and on campus, they're approached by Islamic radical preachers who say to them, "What are you doing with your life? You are a debauched person. You are, as you go, a disgrace to Islam. You have to find a purpose to your life. Your life has to be given meaning." And unfortunately and tragically, the way they give them meaning is to radicalize them to fight for Islam. And this is where the second part of this awful story comes into play, because what they're told is that Islam is under threat. Islam is under attack by the West because of the Islamic radical tendency to invert everything. So what is, from our point of view, they're attacking us becomes actually we, Muslims, are defending ourselves against the West. And I can talk about that a bit because I have a view as to why that is. But that's what these boys are told. We are under attack, and instead of debauching yourself in this way, you redeem yourself by becoming a fighter for your people. You fight to defend your people, Muslims across the world, where they are under attack, and you fight to defend God from an onslaught by the West and by the secular world. And these boys respond to that because they are looking for a purpose to their lives. And then the question is why the non-Muslim world is signing up.
Can we just stay on that point for 1 second? So the part that's confusing for me is that this phenomenon where you take somebody who is in limbo, looking for a purpose, becomes a Muslim. So this is actually an age-old story. This is not, you know, 2014. A good example that a lot of people in the West are familiar with in my generation is Cat Stevens. Right? Cat Stevens in 1977 suddenly changes everything. He drops music, he sells all of his musical equipment, and he becomes Yusuf Islam, which has been his name ever since, and he got married and he has 5 kids, and he's a devoted Muslim. Now, whatever you think about Cat Stevens / Yusuf Islam, he didn't go to Syria and Iraq, right? In other words, and the narrative is very similar, right? He lived this lifestyle, a lot of stuff that he wasn't happy with, and he became a pious Muslim. But he didn't go to Syria and Iraq. And now something new has entered into the mix here. Why is it that they haven't just become pious and, you know, gone away in Birmingham and Manchester and left it at that? Why the jump to actually this kind of radicalism?
Well, the obvious and the sensible, the obvious answer is that that they, like the rest of us, can see what's going on in Iraq, which is in Syria, which is truly terrible. You know, you have a mass slaughter going on. The problem is, and so they want to go and stop the slaughter of fellow Muslims, which you can understand. But the trouble is, and I mean, it's almost impossible to believe the stupidity with which they go, because those of them who sort of wanted to go and possibly those of them who have come back, but a few of them have been asked why you went and what you thought you were doing and who were you fighting for? You're fighting to protect people from being murdered by Assad, but who do you think the opposition is? And they have no idea. They have no idea who's fighting whom. They have no idea who is the good guy and who's the bad guy. Not surprising, neither do we. Who's the good guy? I mean, are there any good guys? But they arrive, and all they know is they've come to protect Islam. It's really as stupid and as simple as that. And a number of them, apparently, when they get there, they realize not only they don't know what they're doing, but they then realize that the Islamic State people are monsters, and then they panic, and then they ring home, as it were, and say, "I want to come back." And they find that Britain is saying, "If you come back, we're going to put you in prison, because we know we cannot trust the fact that you have seen the light. I mean, we cannot take that risk." And so they're stranded. And so you now you have this extraordinary situation where boys who joined up, you could say, for humanitarian reasons, became radicalized, so they became terrorists, and now are almost hostages because Islamic State is saying, if you want to go back to Britain, we are going to kill you. If you do anything that is against what we stand for, we're going to kill you. So this is a tremendous mess. So
you're arguing they're stuck.
They are, well, they're stuck, and Britain is stuck. What does Britain do? Britain has got this tremendous problem. Some of them can be said to have committed a crime, but you have to have the evidence that they've committed a crime, which is basically, you know, acting against Britain. But if a boy has gone, you know, in this vague kind of way, and hasn't actually done anything, well, what do you accuse him of? On what basis do you lock him up, deprive him of his passport? On what basis do you act against him? On the other hand, you cannot possibly just let him come back. So then people say, well, let them come back and de-radicalize them. Well, no one has any confidence in any de-radicalization program. I mean, Saudi Arabia goes in for de-radicalization. They claim to have some success, but I think it's not exactly conclusive, to put it mildly. So Britain is stuck. But there's another thing about Islam, and it's the question of why people are attracted to it. You know, people are looking for a purpose of their lives. Why don't they become Christians? Why, you know, people in prison, classically in prison, people in prison, they're being recruited into Islamic radicalism in droves in Britain. They go into prison convicted. This is non-Muslims. They go into prison convicted of, you know, grievous bodily harm, murder, whatever it is, and they come out as Muslims and violent Muslims. So why is this? Well, this is completely unsayable, so I'll say it. But Islam is a religion that legitimizes violence because, first of all, it doesn't have a code of morality like Jews inflict upon ourselves. You know, we fetter what we do in the interests of others, basically. Islam basically says the religion is the word of God. That's it. You submit. Islam means submission. You submit to the word of God. But there's no code of behavior. Now, there are Muslims who say, well, of course, there's a code of behavior. And I'm sure in the writings there are codes of behavior. But we don't have a Mosaic law like we have. The religion is not constructed around a set of moral laws. And consequently, and more than that, it mandates violence in the name of defending the religion. And so, you know, people are drawn to it because it seems to give a meaning to their lives because it's kind of spiritual. But it doesn't actually expect anything of them. It doesn't actually expect them to constrain their behavior. And I think that is actually one of the main reasons why, so proportionately, so many people are being attracted to Islam from outside the faith to begin with.
So if you take this back to England, there's something strangely then self-liquidating about the English view. And it sounds to me like what you're arguing is that the desire or the need for some kind of political correctness is actually overriding the feeling that this is seriously self-harming. At some point, though, I would imagine that the English are frightened of this phenomenon, and wouldn't that then reverse the trend and make them feel like we have to stop this?
Frightened of which phenomenon?
In other words, frightened of the phenomenon where Lee Rigby is being killed on the street, where James Foley beheader is
right.
British, and so on. So in other words, they can see the writing on the wall a little bit now.
Right.
Wouldn't that overcome the desire to be politically correct?
Well, there are many Britons involved in this. There's the Britain, which is the Britain composed of ordinary people, and there's the Britain composed of the ruling class, the intelligentsia, the political class, and they're very different. The Britain composed of ordinary people has for many years now been beside itself with anxiety and fear and anger about all this. Anxiety and fear because it sees what's happening on the streets around itself. It feels the threat very often if there are, you know, people living in communities where there are a lot of Muslims. And it's not allowed to say it. As soon as you say it, you are damned as an enemy of humanity, as an Islamophobe. And they can see that the governing class is just ignoring it. So that's been building for a long time. Among ordinary people, you know, a perception that Britain is changing, in that the Muslim community of Britain is not behaving like any other minority. Any other minority gets on with its own stuff. practices its religion, it practices its culture, and it enjoys the tolerance of a tolerant society, but it doesn't threaten anyone else, doesn't get anyone else's way, and crucially, it doesn't expect the state to adapt itself to their demands. The trouble with the Muslim community is that it does expect the state to adapt itself to their demands. It does expect the state to change. So you have this phenomenon now where the default food, meat served in British state-run schools is halal. And everyone goes, what? Did we ever know that we were being given halal meat? I mean, it's that. And there's this sense that, you know, bit by bit, the country's kind of being taken away from it. So among ordinary people, there's fury. Fury at what's happening, fury they can't say what's happening, fury their political leaders are allowing it to happen. Now, what's happening with the political leaders? Well, they're petrified. They're petrified and paralyzed. They understood, they've understood for years, since 9/11, they have been on a kind of learning curve, and they understand very well that there is a tremendous danger from Islamic radicalized extremist violence. As you say, after the 7/7 tube bus bombings, there have been numerous plots, far worse than the 7/7 tube bus bombings, which have been uncovered. Thank goodness they were uncovered. But, I mean, devastating plots to blow up there was one which involved flooding the tube tunnels by blowing up the Thames. I mean, it's just awful. So they're under no illusions about the threat from radicalized Muslims. They're under no illusions about the fact that there are more and more being produced in Britain, radicalized young Muslims. They're under no illusions about the threat currently from Islamic State, which is a new type of threat. But they have always been much more frightened by other stuff. They've been very, very frightened by their belief that if they were to really confront this, if they were really to literally go into the mosques and uncover what is in the mosques, the Islamic preachers, and some people say there are weapons stored in mosques. If they were to go into the mosques and treat the mosques as potentially a source of danger, they fear there would be serious violence on the streets of Britain. They fear that radicalized Muslims would take to the streets of Britain and cause mayhem, and that terrorism would then exponentially increase. And they also fear that if they start saying, you know, folks, there is a problem here, and it goes beyond a few radicals, and we're now going to really look at the radicalization that's going on, they fear that the homegrown Brits would start taking matters into their own hands, and then they would have civil war on the streets. That's what they're frightened of. So that's the first thing. That's the main thing they're frightened of. Then they are frightened off in a kind of cultural way because of political correctness. They can't be seen to be down on Muslims because everyone will start shouting at them. Human rights people will start shouting at them. And they feel vulnerable to that. They feel vulnerable to being, you know, denounced and traduced in the media. And consequently, the governing class basically pretends that this is nothing to do with the religion, and it's to do with they never clear up what it's to do with. The latest formulation is it's a perversion of Islam. Okay. So it's a perversion of Islam. It's got nothing to do with Islam. Okay. So it's a perversion of Islam. Fine. It just happens to be a coincidence that everyone doing it is a Muslim. But it's a perversion of Islam. So what is the cause of it? So I've been told in the past, well, it's nothing to do with religion. It's ideology. And I say, fine. What ideology? What kind of ideology? Oh, just ideology. So I say, well, you can't just have just ideology. I mean, is it a religious ideology? Is it a political ideology? What sort of ideology? No, it's just ideology. I mean, it doesn't bear examination. It's just absurd. But it's a way of turning their minds away from what's going on. And it's not just the political class. As I've said before, a significant proportion of these young Muslims in Britain have been radicalised on campus. Now, the universities over the years have literally, they will not address this. They pretend it's not happening. They pretend that it is a tiny problem. Or they say, we cannot possibly stop this because we are committed to freedom of speech and we certainly are not in the business of stopping people coming and speaking on campus or groups being formed. And consequently, they have allowed this to happen on their watch because they simply won't address it. Now, are they not frightened by the consequences? They're more frightened by the consequences themselves of addressing it. They're more frightened. I mean, it is a very threatening situation. They are frightened that they would have, for example, riots on campus. They're frightened that they themselves would be targeted for physical attack. All these things are entirely likely. Entirely likely. So they're not wrong, but they are running away all the time. And so the political governing class is looking on in horror at what's happening, and it's like paralyzed. So it comes up with one thing after another. Years ago, it came up with a program to prevent, it was called Prevent Islamic Extremism. And it was beyond tragic what happened, because Islamic extremism has nothing to do with Islam. So how did they propose to combat Islamic extremism, which was a perversion of Islam? Well, the way you combat Islamic extremism, which is a perversion of Islam, is you tell them true Islam, because that will take them away from extremism. So they gave a lot of public money to organizations which promoted Islamic extremism. Then they said, we have to find a way of reaching out to radicalized people. The way you do that is we have to find a bridge, because we can't do it, because we are, you know, white, waspy people. So we have to find people who have credibility with these young Muslims. So who can we find who has credibility? Well, there are these very interesting folk called the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood have had we all know about the Muslim Brotherhood being the parent of Al-Qaeda, and that's very troubling, very troubling. But, you know, not all the Muslim Brotherhood are bad people. On the contrary, many of them are opposed to violence. They are merely very pious Muslims. So they're a bit crazy in the religious department, but then a lot of people are crazy in the religious department. Not for us to have any kind of view about people's religious views. But basically, they are committed against violence in Britain, which is good enough for us. And we can use these people to be the bridge to this vulnerable group of young Muslims. We will use the Muslim Brotherhood to be our emissaries to them in order that the Muslim Brotherhood will teach these young Muslims what true Islam is as a religion of peace. The result is a huge spike in radicalization, paid for by the British taxpayer. Now, I mean, this always was beyond belief. And it's beyond credibility that people can be quite so stupid. But it makes perfect sense if you start from the position that it's got nothing to do with the religion. And then everything, all this absurdity follows from that. And they're still, I mean, they've moved on. They now think that the Muslim Brotherhood is possibly a bad thing. The Prime Minister caused a sensation two or three months ago, when he suddenly announced, apparently out of the blue, that he was setting up an inquiry into whether the Muslim Brotherhood should be banned. And we all went, what? 5 minutes ago, they were, you know, being used as agents of the state, and now they're being possibly fingered as bad people. What's happened? And I can't tell you what happened, but someone has got to Mr. Cameron and said, actually, we've got a problem here. We've got a serious problem with the brothers. And an inquiry has been set up under an Arabist who was a former ambassador to Saudi Arabia. And we await his inquiry report with great interest. None of us can believe that the British government is actually going to ban the Muslim Brotherhood. That would be sensible. None of us can believe that they would do anything sensible in this regard. But there it is, an inquiry. So bit by bit, the government is being dragged along to a more sensible position, but they are nowhere near it yet.
You know, Jews often complain about the attitude of Westerners or Western elites and governments to Jews and to Israel and so forth. And what's in a way more striking to me is their attitude to Christians. In other words, you have a serious and very underreported phenomenon. It's the question of the violation of the human rights of Christians in the Middle East and Africa. And there are many stories, right, about the bombing of churches, the persecution of priests, and of course the several hundred schoolgirls which were kidnapped by Boko Haram in Nigeria. These are Christian girls. So I'm thinking about this from a pragmatic perspective, because I find that even more bewildering, in a sense, than anti-Semitism, because you're talking about the persecution of the majority faith in the West. So I'm wondering, why aren't America and Britain at least more vigorous in their protection of Christian rights if they're not going to be concerned about Jewish ones?
Well, the real question is why the churches are silent about
it. Right.
Because, I mean, that's the really extraordinary thing. You have, you know, the mass slaughter of Christians going on. Some people say that Christianity is basically being systematically extinguished in its birthplace. In Iraq, they have been slaughtered, driven out. But not just in Iraq and in the Middle East. If you look at Africa, Christians being burned alive in churches in Nigeria. You mentioned Boko Haram. I mean, it's rampant across the developing world. And the astonishing thing is that the church is almost completely silent. And this is the most amazing thing. And as you say, the political class also is completely silent. Now, why is the church silent? I mean, quite honestly, you need a psychiatrist up here rather than me. But what is indisputable is that the Church of England, faced with the slaughter of its people in the Anglican Communion across the world, responded to this by dumping big time on its Jewish parent and embracing its assassin, is what's happened. The two are connected. The church doesn't just remain silent about the persecution of Christians across the world, but over the last several years, it has promulgated tremendous amount of dialogue, interfaith dialogue, but more than interfaith dialogue, it's made a concordat with Islam. In which it basically has gone a very long way to accepting that, you know, Islam is entirely valid and its complaints are valid, and it, in the course of that, it has basically torn up its previous connection to Judaism in all kinds of ways. It doesn't acknowledge it anymore. It used to be the case that if you were a trainee priest, apparently, I'm told, then, you know, you were taught Hebrew because that's the language that you had to learn in order to understand Christianity. No more. Insofar as you are offered any language as a trainee priest, it's Arabic. And insofar as you are offered, you know, education in other faiths, it is Islam. You're offered, you know, academic, as it were, stays in Saudi Arabia, in Mecca, whatever it is. and so why is this happening? Well, it's fear, I believe. I mean, it's the classic appeasement mentality. But I think it's based on something deeper than that. I think that the progressive churches and the Anglican churches is the sort of leader of the progressive churches in a way. long ago, they basically lost their faith. I mean, the Anglican church stopped being a believing church, believing in, you know, the truth of the Bible and promoting, you know, the word of God and the word of Jesus and all that sort of stuff. and instead turned it itself into a church of social work at home, and humanitarian pro-liberation movements, defeat of poverty abroad, as a replacement for religious faith. Well, if you've lost your religious faith, then you have nothing to stop you. There is nothing that you want to defend. And there's no point going to war, as it were, against Islam in order to defend social work. I mean, who on earth would do that? You're not defending any body of doctrine anymore. You're not defending, your God against their attempt to destroy your God, because you don't have a God anymore. And that's the rot at the very heart of the Anglican Church, and I believe the progressive churches, which means that they are then, the way is clear for them to say, we just got to stop the slaughter, and we can stop the slaughter by being nice to these people. And if we're nice to these people and reach out to these people and show them that we're nice people because we're Christians and we turn the other cheek, then they won't hate us anymore. It's as simple and as stupid as that. And in the course of that, they are dumping on Israel, classically. Part of that is just a revival of the ancient Christian theological dislike of and doctrinal dislike of Jews. But partly it's because it goes hand in hand with this embrace of Islam. And so you have this absurd situation a few years ago where the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, a man who notably made a notable speech on one occasion and said, we should embrace Sharia law in Britain. We have nothing to fear from Sharia law. Sharia law is merely just, the Sharia courts are just like the Jewish Beth Din. Just like the Jewish Beth Din. I mean, he's an educated man. He is an intellectual. He must know that there is an absolute difference between the Jewish religious courts and the Islamic religious courts. The Beth Din, the Bat Hei Din, are based on the diaspora Jewish principle, the law of the land is the law. So the Bat Hei Din, their law is all an informal arbitration system. That's all it is. You don't get married unless you are married by the law of the land. It's always under the law of the land. The point about Sharia is that Islamic Sharia law is that it doesn't recognize any secular system of law at all. It doesn't recognize any authority above itself. So in and of itself, Sharia is a challenge to a democratic system, because a Sharia court basically says, we're not under the law of the land, we are instead of the law of the land. And that's the difference, and that's why Sharia is so very dangerous, and why the Beth Din is not. And to equate the two, for the Archbishop of Canterbury to equate the two was really dreadful. But the point was, he did it in order to say, we should embrace Sharia. There's no problem about Sharia. The fact that, under Sharia, women, Muslim women are second-class citizens at best and oppressed and attacked at worst was also not mentioned. So you have that situation where he's embracing Islam. So he made a sermon at Christmas time a few years ago in which he addressed the plight of the Bethlehem Christians. Now, the Bethlehem Christians are indeed in an appalling situation. Bethlehem used to be a majority Christian town. I don't know what it was, 80% Christian, something like that. And by the time when the Archbishop of Canterbury was doing this lecture, giving the sermon, it was down to, 30-40%. It's now probably less. So no question, the Palestinian, the Bethlehem Christians have been driven out of Bethlehem, no question. But the Archbishop of Canterbury blamed Israel. It was just staggering. He said the reason that they are in this terrible situation is the wall and the checkpoints. The wall and the checkpoints. Now, a moment's thought would tell you, if it's the wall and the checkpoints which are driving out Bethlehem, which are driving out Christians from Bethlehem, why aren't the wall and the checkpoints driving out Muslims from Bethlehem? Perhaps Israel has a sudden terrible animus against Christians all of a sudden that we didn't hear about? It makes no sense. It also made absolutely no sense because, as anyone knows, Israel is the only country in the Middle East where Christians are totally protected, where their freedom of worship is totally protected, and where they are thriving and increasing. And as anyone who has any dealings in Bethlehem knows, the Christians have been driven out by the Muslim administration in Bethlehem, who systematically persecute them, harass them, and drive them out. And they will say that, if they're too frightened to say it, but they will say it. And it's quite obvious. And so the Archbishop of Canterbury blamed Israel. And I took this up with an archbishop, and I said, how can he possibly say this when the evidence is the opposite, that Israel is the only place where Christians are protected, and the Bethlehem Christians are being driven out by the Muslim administration. There was a Muslim administration. He wasn't even referred to by the Archbishop of Canterbury. How can this be? I said to this archbishop. And he just smiled at me benignly, because he was a Christian. That's what they do. They smile at you benignly. And he gave me, in his gentle and benign way, a pamphlet, so that I should educate myself. And I looked at the pamphlet, and it was written by an Arab, and it was all about the persecution of Bethlehem's Christians by Israel. In other words, that archbishop was immune to facts. Again, this is extraordinary thing in Britain. You can't deal with this by facts anymore and evidence. If people have a view, it's immune to evidence that challenges that view, which is it's another feature of what's happened to British society. So you have a situation where, for the Christian world, Israel has become the scapegoat, the thing that is driving prejudice and bigotry and oppression and terror and tyranny in the region, and they're ignoring completely the slaughter of their own people across the developing world at the hands of Muslims. And this is beyond astonishing. And as you say, no Western leader stands up and says, what is going on here? Because no Western leader is prepared to challenge the Islamic world for anything. They are simply not, because they're frightened of the domestic situation on their own streets, and I suppose also they are intimidated by the ties they have with the Islamic world, ties of mainly finance. Money is so important. They are tied to Saudi Arabia, to Iran, by these immense amounts of money flowing back and forth. They don't want to upset the apple cart. That's why in Britain, they are presiding over a situation in which Saudi Arabia, Qatar, these terrible places which are funding the murder of people, are funding university departments of religion. This was happening years ago when I wrote my book, Londonistan. It was already happening then. You have, classically, Saudi Arabia coming forward with an endowment. The university, cash-strapped, says, thank you very much. We'll have this endowment. We'll set it up. Sheikh whatnot, Center for Islamic Studies. Okay, so the British lecturers and professors of religious studies are then told they have to teach Islam in a different way. Instead of teaching it in the way that is required in the West, you teach it as an objective study. You teach the religion in the context of the time, the 7th century, this is how you interpret it. No, you teach it as the Word of God. This is homegrown British lecturers. Religious studies lecturers, and when they went to their vice chancellors and said, I can't do this, this is propaganda, this is not education, this is indoctrination, and they were told, you do it or you go. And that's what's happening, and no one says anything because everyone wants the money, and that also is changing the way in which religion is taught. And that is also having an effect on the church. The church is party to this, willingly party to this, because they've basically, lost the plot in themselves and done this terrible sort of Faustian deal with Islam.
I think there's a sort of strange ambivalence in our home turf as well.
In Canada?
No, in Israel. So you and I both live about 10 minutes from Abu Tor, right? And Abu Tor this week was the scene of a man who went to the Begin Center and shot Yehuda Glick, who was somebody who was an activist for Jews going up to the Temple Mount. It turned out that the SWAT team came in on Thursday. The helicopters were flying around and came into Abu Tor and shot him. But all this also speaks to, you know, Israel's also its own dilemma with what to do with this kind of flashpoint of religion, whether they should assert their rights in terms of at least being able to worship freely or not. I'm not talking about any halachic issues. I'm just talking about the social issue of whether you can go up there. So I think every country now has its own negotiation to make with this issue, whether it's Britain or it's Israel or even here in Canada. You might have read that, you know, in the past 2 weeks, there was the incidents in Ottawa and in Quebec. But I'm assuming that you feel that the issues in North America are largely financial as opposed to a Muslim polity. In other words, in Britain and France, they really have to worry about the man on the street. And North America, I have a feeling that you're arguing that the ties are more financial than worrying about their electorate.
Sorry, where are the ties financial?
In other words, if North Americans are intimidated, I wouldn't think they would be intimidated so much about rioting on their streets as they would be, say, in Paris or in, you know, Bradfield. I think they would be more worried about the sort of economic consequences of rebuffing.
Yes, I mean, there are several elements here. First of all, the United States is behind Britain and Europe in this respect, because its Islamic population is becoming more radical, but hitherto it hasn't been so radical. It's a different demographic, and so they haven't had a problem on the streets in the way that Europe has had it.
Right.
But I would say it's coming. I would say there are parts of America now which, you know, under the radar, because America has told itself that, you know, it's quite different from Europe. It hasn't realized what's been happening, especially in the last 6 years, where radical elements in certain areas, for example, Detroit, have been allowed to grow. And my understanding is that in the administration of government, brotherhood types have been brought in and allowed to be in, and you know it's not recognised yet. But I think that America has a much bigger problem in this respect than people think. The problem of radicalisation is going on across the world, and the problem is that it's feeding upon itself because it's not being challenged properly and stopped anywhere. You mentioned Israel, and you mentioned Ottawa. The situation in Jerusalem has been exceptionally difficult and very, very tense for the last few weeks, with a tremendous number of low-level attacks going on from Al-Aqsa. Pitched battles going on around Al-Aqsa, which have not been widely reported because the Israel government has been trying to keep the lid on it and has been keeping it really, really quite quiet. A lot of attacks in East Jerusalem, a lot of rioting going on, attacks on individual Israelis, and then this attempt to murder Yehuda Glick outside the Begin Center, as you say, by apparently this guy from Abu Tor. And Abu Tor is where Israeli Arabs live, and it's reasonably quiet. I say reasonably quiet because there's a certain amount of low-level vandalism that goes on all the time there, tires being slashed and that kind of thing. But it's never been more than that. Suddenly there's this guy who comes out of Abu Tor and tries to kill Yehuda Glick. Now, part of this increasingly incendiary atmosphere in Jerusalem has been incited by Mahmoud Abbas, who basically has said in terms, you know, we have to defend Al-Aqsa because the Jewish settlers, was the term he used, the Jewish settlers are coming in to desecrate it. And he's basically whipping up hysteria and potential murder. And that's a very large reason why there is this increase in tension. Plus, I believe other elements are also involved. Islamist elements, maybe I've read Qatar is stirring the pot. Qatar-based Islamist radicals are stirring the pot in Jerusalem. So there is a concerted effort to manufacture a kind of low-level intifada in Jerusalem that's been going on for weeks. The Ottawa thing came apparently out of the blue. People say it was because, you know, Canada said it would be acting against Islamic State and so on and so forth. But I believe that if you go back to Israel for a moment, the incitement by Abbas is very important, but I believe that the what happened in the summer, the importance of it, I think, is very great. Protective Edge. What happened in Protective Edge was that Israel achieved what it set out to achieve. It did not set out to defeat Hamas in Gaza, because I believe it thinks that however bad Hamas is, if Hamas were to be defeated in Gaza, there would be worse. Either you have worse Islamists, or possibly even worse for Israel, you would have had Abbas back in power in Gaza, and then the pressure for a Palestine state would have been unstoppable. Either way, it was quite clear Israel did not want to remove Hamas. It wanted to weaken it. It wanted to keep it in place, but weaken it. So it achieved its objectives. Militarily, it achieved its objectives. Now, as we know, it was vilified and demonized by a complete big lie that was told, that it set out to that it reacted in such a way that it willfully killed children, that most of the Gazan casualties were civilians, and that a vast number of those were children, and it didn't care. It didn't care. So it was painted as inhuman, absolutely inhuman, and this incited riotous demonstrations throughout Britain and Europe during that period. And attacks in Britain on Jews went up by 500%, verbal and physical. And attacks in Paris, in France, were much worse. It was much more violent. And across Europe, there was this wave of violence against Jews, and this uncritical, produced by this uncritical promulgation by the Western media of Hamas propaganda. It was all lies, it was all Hamas propaganda. The vast majority of casualties were not civilians. In fact, Israel achieved in Protective Edge a stupendously low ratio of civilian to combatant casualties compared to any other army. In most wars, Iraq, Afghanistan, Bosnia, the ratio of civilians to combatants who are killed is 3-1, and I think in Bosnia it was 4-1. In other words, for every combatant, for every terrorist, for every fighter who was killed, three civilians were killed, or four civilians were killed. That's the norm. In Protective Edge, as in previous Israel operations in Gaza, the latest figures suggest that it was something like 51% of the casualties were civilian and 49% were terrorists. In other words, it was almost half and half, almost 1-1. Now, that is a low level of civilian casualties, which is unheard of in any other war. In other words, Israel went to heroic lengths to try to protect civilian life in circumstances in which it was uniquely difficult for it to do so because the Hamas were using the population of Gaza as human shields and human sacrifices. This was turned completely on its head, and Israel was presented as this dreadful country full of inhuman baby killers. In Britain, Jews were told, why are you supporting baby killers? I mean, we were just, you know, friends were on Facebook telling other friends, why are you supporting baby killers? I mean, it's just astonishing. Now, if you are the Arab world, you look at this and you think this is a stupendous success. A stupendous success. Forget the Hamas in Gaza. The real point is what it done to the Western mind. We went to war. We have thrown millions. We have thrown thousands of rockets at Israel. Israel came in and went to heroic lengths to protect civilians. And look what happened. They bought our propaganda totally. So our aggression was represented as not aggression at all, in that we, as the aggressors, have been represented as the victims in this. So let's do more aggression. It's what the West did in Protective Edge was it basically said to the Arab world, it didn't knowingly say this, but in effect, the message it was giving was, the more you try to murder the Jews of Israel, the more violence you produce against them, the more we'll support you. The more we'll buy into your propaganda. That's what the Western reaction to Protective Edge has done. And so that, to me, is the incitement. That's why Abbas is inciting this. Partly is because of, you know, he is manoeuvring with Hamas and other actors in the region. That's obviously part of it. But part of it is, it's like, wow, look what they did in Gaza. If we can have even more of an effect, because if we can now provoke Israel into doing things in Jerusalem, and we know that they will all say, you know, it's the settlements, it's East Jerusalem. The Israelis should not be in East Jerusalem. It's coming. Wait for it. It's coming. The settlements are illegal. Why are they in East Jerusalem? That's what's coming, and that's behind all this incitement. And this, in turn, creates a kind of mood among Muslims and Islamic radicals across the world that, you know, it incites people to take matters into their own hands because there is this mood of impunity to violence in the Islamic cause. And I'm not sure that's necessarily behind what happened in Ottawa, but it does strike me as, you know, it's part of a general pattern there is this sense that, from the Islamist point of view, you know, they can see that the West is kind of reeling. It's reeling backwards. And while it's reeling backwards, Islamists say, we have them. We have them. They're reeling backwards. Look what's happening in Canada. Look what's happening in Britain. They don't know what to do. They're panicking. Look what's happening in Israel. They don't know what to do. And so let's reinforce the attack. Let's increase the attack, because all we need to do is ratchet it up, and then we have them. And so the problem is that there has been no significant pushback to this, that the Arab and Muslim world can see as a sign of strength. The Arab and Muslim world believes in strength. In the West, we believe that anyone who believes in strength is fascist. So we can't believe in strength. We can't believe in strength. We can't do that. But the Arab and Muslim world believes in strength and weakness. They see weakness, they move in. They see strength, they pull back. It's as simple as that. We see strength as illegitimate. We see strength as fascist. So we don't do strength. We do conflict resolution. We do peace process. We do interfaith dialogue. We don't do strength, because that might end up killing people. And we don't do that because we are too civilized. And the Arab Muslim world says, we got them, because they're never going to defend themselves. And that's, to me, the wider picture behind all these things that are happening.
So the retreat, let's say the American retreat from Pax Americana, where you have a situation now where since 2008, American allies feel like they're no longer allies, they're no longer supported. What would you say is the motivation for this retreat? I mean, you've talked a little bit about not wanting to seem like a neo-fascist, but there may be other elements as well, I suspect.
You're tempting me to talk about President Obama. There are two elements to this. One is President Obama himself, and one is the kind of a more general mindset. The more general mindset is it's been caused by the debacle in Iraq. Even Americans who, you know, were gung-ho in the sense that they believed that Saddam Hussein was a bad man and a threat to them and he should be taken out and so on. But that mood, which was not the case in Britain was always, it's going to be Vietnam, it's going to be a quagmire, right from the start. But America wasn't like that from the start. But America became like that because of the terrible body count. Because of what happened after the fall of Saddam, which, in my view, from that point on, it was utter incompetence by the Americans, utter incompetence, by the Bush administration. They got everything completely wrong. And the result was this terrible war and this terrible body count. And Americans became horrified and distressed. And then there was Afghanistan, which, you know, is very difficult. And in my view, America, despite the apparent bellicosity of President Bush, it never committed itself properly to Afghanistan. It never committed itself, it was incompetent in Iraq, and it never committed itself properly to Afghanistan. And it made many mistakes. So America kind of became horrified by the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan. And a mood developed, it seems to me, in America, which was not so dissimilar from the mood in Britain and Europe, which is a mood of isolationism. Pull up the drawbridge. Look, you know, they're all crazy. We can't possibly hope to stop the craziness. Whatever we do, we've made a terrible muck of it because we just don't understand that world. And so we've just got to make sure that we never again sacrifice our boys needlessly. And that mood is being capitalized by someone like Rand Paul, who may well do well politically. I don't know. I mean, I don't follow it in that sort of detail. But what I do see is the Republican Party is all over the place. It doesn't know. There is no strong voice coming out to say, this is a war of civilization. We have to win it. We're in it for the long haul. We've made these various mistakes. Now we have to identify the problem. Now we have to fight it. And we are not going to give in. We are going to fight it with everything that we have because this is as important as the war on Nazism. If they were to say that, that would be clear. But they don't say that because they are uncertain. So there is a mood in America which is a mood of isolationism. And then you have President Obama. And it is said of President Obama that he is an isolationist. It is said of President Obama that he is simply incompetent. A lot of people think he is just a schlemiel. I mean, he's just a sort of idiot. He's like out to lunch. All he wants to do is play golf. And what is it with this guy? And he's just idiotic. He's naive, he's inexperienced, he can't be bothered, whatever it is. That's basically the Obama is incompetent analysis. I don't buy that. I think there is incompetence, but it follows from something else. And the something else is Obama's worldview, which I think he has enacted to the letter, and he said he was going to enact it. His worldview, from where he is coming from, is that he wishes. I mean, he said this originally. He wanted to even up the score in the world. That America had done bad things in the world. America had done bad things to the developing world, and it caused all this terrible resentment, which had turned the developing world against America and against the West. And he entirely sympathized with this. America had done these terrible things, and it was time to redress the balance. So America would retreat from its historic conception of itself as, you know, American exceptionalism. American exceptionalism was basically a sort of racist, white racist concept. It would no longer be American exceptionalism. It would no longer be trying to bring American exceptionalism to the rest of the world. This had done terrible damage. It would retreat from that. It would look after itself, and it would turn its eyes to its own sort of economic interests across the Pacific in the developing Asian economies. But it would retreat from Pax Americana. It would no longer be the defender of peace and of freedom and democracy in the world, because that was kind of colonialist, and it would not do that anymore. And it would have to even up the score. And the way he's evening up the score is by bringing on bad people. So he brings on Iran. He brings on the Muslim Brotherhood. He sucks up to Turkey, which is now run by an Islamist. He does this amazing deal during Protective Edge. He did this amazing deal with Qatar of, you know, many trillions of dollars. These are people who are against the West. And it's no coincidence, because he wishes to even it up. I mean, it's bizarre, and it makes no sense, and it's utterly destructive, and it's against Western interests. But that's where he's coming from, and I've always thought that's what he was going to do because he said it. But also, if you look at his trajectory, where he's come from, he's very, very ideological. Many of us had radical pasts, and you know, people grow out of those radical pasts, and then they become, you know, conservative people or middle class. It's very unfair to pillory them for their pasts, because they've become something different. With Obama, he didn't become something different. If you read everything that he has written, insofar as we're allowed to read what he's written, and everything written, you know, all the friends and associations he's had over the years, it's very clear. It's a black power mentality in which there is this resentment against the white world for having kept down black people of colour, both at home and abroad, and that his historic mission is to repair that terrible wrong by evening up the score. And that's what he set out to do, and that's what he's doing. He's evening up the score. So I don't see it as isolationist at all, but it's playing into a mood of isolationism caused by this despair at what appears to be and is this tremendously complex, almost impenetrably complicated situation in the Arab and Muslim world, where it's imploding before our eyes, and not knowing what to do about it. You know, whose side are we on? Should we intervene? Should we not intervene? These are genuinely very difficult and complex questions. And people are scarred by the experience of Iraq and Afghanistan, and they just don't want anything to do with it. So there is this mood of isolationism. You have a president who is ideological, and you have this mood of isolationism. So you have America retreating from its historic role. And the question to me is, what follows from next week, in fact? Next week? The midterms. It's a source of some alarm. Once the midterms are over, Obama has got nothing to lose anymore. And what's he going to do? So there's that worry. But then the broader concern that I have is what comes after Obama. Because if one could see that there was an alternative discourse in American politics, an alternative view which said, look, you know, we are facing now a civilizational war, and we have to win it. But we don't see anyone saying that. So I don't immediately see who is going to restore America's role to what it was. And I don't even know whether it can be restored. I don't know whether there is the will to do it, because I don't see any politician who is coming forward and saying it.
So you're arguing it's not, you know, it's not naivete, it's not stupidity, it's not, right, it's ideology. And in a way, that was the, you know, I want to bring our discussion to a close by just focusing on this theme, which really you talked about in The World Upside Down, which is the flight from reason in the West and the replacement of truth from ideology. And I'm wondering, you know, if you go back historically in the West, the project really begins post-Renaissance in the Enlightenment, right, where you have this notion of reason, the rise of science, the idea that things will be negotiated not through religion and ideology, because the Enlightenment is obviously a reaction to the notion of the sort of crush and coercion that came from religion in the previous 1,000 years. And that was now going to be replaced by fact, by rationality, by equality, by certain discourses that have become second nature in the West. If I understand you correctly, you're arguing that this project is in a way spiraling down and is about to come to its end. And do I have that correctly?
Yes. When the Soviet Union fell, Francis Fukuyama wrote a book called The End of History, and basically said, now the Soviet Union has fallen, history is over, by which he meant the world is now going to become democratic. Everyone now sign up to democracy, because the Soviet Union has fallen. And this was entirely wrong, because As we can see, democracy is by no means a universal creed. But I think that the real thing that happened was on the level of culture, which meant that far from the idea. When the Soviet Union fell, people said that's the end of ideology because it's the end of Soviet ideology. In Britain, the intelligence service basically wound up its subversion section because subversion was over. The Soviet Union was over, subversion was over, ideology was over. Terrible mistake, because what people didn't realize was happening, what I think was happening, was a process that had been going on at least since the end of the Second World War, which was the triumph of ideology. Not Soviet ideology, the triumph of other ideologies, and I'll explain. This is the march of secularism. This is basically saying God is dead. This is basically saying we are now the age of reason, and the age of reason means that we don't believe anymore. People who believe in who have religious belief, people who believe in God, are basically stupid, or else they're insane. But they're basically stupid. They are too ignorant and they're too stupid to realize that, you know, the world wasn't made in 6 days, and because, you know, if you believe in the Bible, you believe in the literal truth of the Bible, okay? They never heard of Jews, these people, but anyway. People are too stupid to realize the world can be explained. Everything in the world can be explained by materialism. Everything in the world can be explained by science. And because we are rational, and because this is the age of reason, we know that these biblical stories are fairy stories. So out the window went God. I'm talking about Europe. I'm not talking about America. Out the window went God. And out the window went the idea of divinely inspired ideas, because that was just too stupid. So in came, instead of divinely inspired ideas, in came man-made ideas. And those man-made ideas are ideologies. They are ideas which are invented by man for the betterment of mankind. They're all utopian ideas. All these isms and ideologies are utopian ideas. We can all think of isms and ideologies of this kind. Multiculturalism, environmentalism, moral relativism. Okay, so moral relativism, the idea that what is right for me is right, is the way of liberating people so they can be free. We can all be free. We can all realize our inner person. And therefore, we release ourselves from slavery. So it's utopian. We are free. Environmentalism. We save the planet. We save the planet. We do green stuff. We save the planet. And anyone who doesn't agree is really evil because they wish not to save the planet. Multiculturalism. Multiculturalism means that we believe that every culture is equal to every other culture, and that way you eradicate prejudice and bigotry from the human heart. So it's utopian. You get rid of prejudice. So you save the planet, you get rid of prejudice, you promote freedom, what's not to like. It's all utopian. Right. Now these are the doctrines of ideas, and they are absolutely everywhere. But the problem with the doctrine of ideas, the problem with ideology is this. In my world, you try to work out what you think by looking at evidence. You look at facts, you look at evidence, you apply logic to that evidence, and you build up an argument, and you look at other arguments, and then you arrive bit by bit at a conclusion. With an ideology, you start at the other end. You start with the conclusion, because the ideology is the idea, and the idea cannot be challenged. The idea cannot be challenged because the idea is utopian. You mean you don't want to save the planet? Then you must be a really bad person. You are going to personally destroy the planet. You don't believe in multiculturalism? That means you must want to promote bigotry. It's that. It's the idea is unchallengeable. Because it's utopian, because the idea, if you adhere to the idea, you produce the perfection of the world in these various ways. So the idea is unchallengeable. Anyone who is not signed up to the idea becomes a really bad person. And consequently, if the idea is unchallengeable, then any evidence that challenges the idea cannot be admitted. A very good example of this was in the field of environmentalism, where there was a great scandal a few years ago involving the University of East Anglia, which is a very prominent green centre of green thinking and global warming, man-made global warming theory. Very, very important. And a great scandal erupted because it was discovered through a cache of emails that came to light, thousands of emails, that the University of East Anglia's unit, global warming unit, had been systematically suppressing evidence that climate, far from rising, far from the temperature rising, the temperature had been flatlining and even depressing a bit. So there was a great scandal because the University of East Anglia scientists had basically not just suppressed the information, but they'd kind of taken action against scientists who'd been trying to bring it out. So it was a great academic scandal. But the thing that really struck me was one thing that one of these East Anglia scientists said, trying to justify the fact that he had suppressed his information. He said, "Words to the effect of, we had a moral duty to suppress this information. Because if we'd accepted it, if we'd actually accepted that this research was true, then it would have meant that our theory was false. It would have meant that global warming wasn't happening. And that's impossible. That's impossible. It's impossible that it's not happening. So we had a moral duty to suppress this information, because otherwise people might have thought that the theory of man-made global warming wasn't true." That's what he said, and he believed it. He believed it. In other words, it's like a fanaticism. If you are enthralled to an idea which cannot be challenged, you must deny the truth. You must deny evidence. That, incidentally, is why, in my view, the West is so vulnerable to Islamic extremism. Because when Islamic extremism comes along and inverts the truth, when it says the indigenous people of Israel were the Palestinian Muslims going back to time immemorial, and by the way, Jesus was a Palestinian, it's mad. But the West says, okay, well, that's their narrative. Because the West already has inverted stuff like on global warming or like on multiculturalism, in which it cannot admit to any evidence that challenges the idea. So the West is enthralled to ideology. Ideology in and of itself is inimical to truth, because evidence must be wrenched to fit the idea rather than the evidence being looked at and then you arrive at your conclusion. The conclusion is immutable, unchallengeable, and so the evidence must be turned to fit the idea. And if you therefore turn evidence, if you therefore deny that there is such a thing as truthful evidence, you must deny that there are such a thing as lies. And so you're lost. You're completely lost. And this is where Britain is. It's lost. It can no longer tell the difference between truth and lies. Everything's a matter of narrative, and there are some narratives which are unchallengeable because they embody perfection. And that is why history did not end. That is why, in my view, we are a society in the West which is ideology riven. Britain is the leader of this because Britain is the most post-religious of all the societies. Britain is the country which, because of the Church of England, because the Church of England is the established church, lost the divine plot some time ago. Unlike America, the church is not a bulwark against this. The church is actually in the forefront of this. So, and there are other reasons too. Britain lost the plot in itself. You know, when it famously lost an empire and never found a role, it lost. It became demoralised, and it's become demoralised in every sense. So, Britain is the most post-religious society, which has made it vulnerable to all these. It's made it vulnerable to the doctrines of man-made ideas, as a result of which it's made it particularly an irrational society. And in my view, I mean, Britain was just about the first country that was into the Enlightenment, and it's now the first country out. And that's, unfortunately, what Britain is doing to the world, because where Britain leads today, the rest of the English-speaking world follows tomorrow. Britain is much diminished in its political clout in the world as a small nation, which no longer has an empire and all the rest of it. But culturally, it is still the leader of the English-speaking world. And what it thinks today, the rest of the English-speaking world will think tomorrow. So it's actually very, very important. And the demoralization that I'm talking about that has gripped Britain, which I think has hollowed out its culture, has made it absolutely vulnerable to the Islamic extremists who have understood precisely what's gone on in Britain. And that's why they targeted Britain for the centre of the jihad outside the Islamic world. It's destroying itself from within and making itself vulnerable to forces from without. And the great question is what we can all do about this. Is it therefore, as you started by saying, is it therefore all over? Well, I've said before, and for those of you who have heard this, I apologize for saying it again, but in my view, it's not over until the fat lady says Kaddish. We have to keep on keeping on. There are many, many thousands, millions of people in Britain and Europe who agree with our perspective, who have not lost the plot, who have not become irrational, who understand the danger that the civilization is in. But they are leaderless. They need leaders. We all need leaders. But hopefully, I mean, people are listening all the time, and hopefully we will find leaders coming forward to lead us properly, to defend us against this kind of thing. But we can only expect that to happen if we keep putting on the pressure, as far as we're concerned, which is basically talking like this, exposing what's going on, articulating what we believe to be the truth, and urging that other people can see things as clearly as we can.
Amen. So I just want to say that evenings like this don't occur tabula rasa. There's many people to thank. I want to begin, trying to find where you are. I want to thank especially Joel Rabinovich and his partners for helping to sponsor this evening. Thank you very much. I want to thank the good folks of Sherah Shemaim for once again being our partners here at Torah in Motion and for giving graciously of their space and their logistics. Thank you. And, of course, I want to thank you for coming and sharing your thoughts and your perspectives with us so articulately and so powerfully. Thank you very much.